Welcome to the program, Our Father's Plan, with Jeff Cavins and Scott Hahn.
We want to welcome you to Our Father's Plan. I'm Jeff Cavins, along with Dr. Scott Hahn. And in this series, we're taking a look at God's Word. The program is called Our Father's Plan, and He does have a plan for you, and we're discovering it in the Bible. We're taking a look at the Bible. Specifically, I'm teaching how to read the Bible in chronological order, and Dr. Hahn is looking at some theological concepts, going a bit deeper into these theological concepts. I'd just like to open today's program by reading a scripture from you that hopefully will give you some hope, because your Father wants you to have hope. It comes from Jeremiah chapter 29 and verse 11. "For I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope." Dr. Hahn, last program you said some very interesting things about Adam. And I wanted to begin today's program by reviewing a little bit about Adam and his relationship to Eve. Can you give us just a little synopsis of what you talked about last time?
Okay. For background, think of it this. Genesis 1 describes creation as a sacred home or temple. Then in Genesis 2, it follows that the Garden of Eden is being described in unique terms that reflect the sanctuary or the Holy of Holies. That implies that when God creates Adam, He's not just creating the founding father of the human family, He's creating Adam to be our king and high priest. And so in Genesis 2, Adam discovers that God is putting him on trial in a way, that God is going to test his faithfulness as a son. So when you move into the temptation narrative of chapter 3, you recognize that Adam's sin is a sin of pride, but it's a sin of pride that is being committed under challenging circumstances, you might say. And the text in Genesis 2 sets the stage for that in certain ways. For instance, we see a tree of life. We might wonder, why is there any need for a tree of life if Adam is already immortal? It suggests, or it might imply, that there's a need for something to seal and protect his immortality. Likewise, Adam is commanded to guard the garden, not just cultivate it. And the term there implies that there might be something to guard it from. And then when the bride is presented to Adam, he meets Eve for the first time. It describes how they come together in intimacy and how the man and his wife were both naked and not ashamed. And in the very next verse, the opening verse of chapter 3, the serpent is introduced as being more subtle. And the Hebrew word for subtle is almost identical with the Hebrew word for naked, implying for most interpreters that the serpent is entering the garden in order to test, in order to challenge the human couple in their, you know, their naked marital harmony and bliss, but also in their vulnerability. So I would suggest, my intriguing proposal is that that Adam is being tested not just in some generic sense, but specifically in terms of his covenantal role as husband, as the mediator of a marital covenant. Is he going to be the provider, the protector that his bride needs him to be? And what is so provocative then is not the fact that the woman is, you know, being interrogated by the serpent, or that the woman is sort of fumbling in her words as she answers the questions raised by the serpent, but what's so loud, what's so noisy, is Adam's silence. The fact is, he's there, but he's quiet.
That's what was intriguing to me, is that you seem to be implying that Adam was silent while his wife was being interrogated.
Well, yeah, because the Hebrew word for serpent isn't just, you know, pointing to a little snake hanging from a tree branch or something. The term Nahash is used elsewhere in Scripture to describe Leviathan, this great dragon. In Revelation 12, verse 9, it's used to describe Satan, the ancient serpent, this great dragon with seven heads and ten horns. And in fact, Pope John Paul II gave catechesis on this material, on original sin. And he describes how Adam was confronted by the tempter, by the devil, in the form of the serpent. And he quotes Revelation 12:9 to suggest that this was no mere snake. This serpent is a life-threatening symbol. And so we have to factor that into our interpretation. Now, I would suggest that when the serpent begins interrogating the woman, he begins with a question. He says, "Did God say?" So there's no lie there. And then when she answers, he comes back and says, you will not die. Now, Professor Moberly over in England wrote an article entitled, Did the Serpent Get It Right? And he made the intriguing observation that when they ate, they didn't die. Now, wait a second. Does that mean that the serpent got it right and that God got it wrong? No, because what God was speaking of was not instant physical death. That took place centuries later. He was talking about spiritual death, mortal sin. The day that you eat of it, you shall die. That is to say, our covenant bond will be severed and shattered. But when the serpent says you will not die, there's a sense in which it's true. The purpose of the statement, however, is deceitful, to tempt, to test. The serpent said to the woman, you will not die. For God knows when you eat of it, your eyes will be open and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. And once again, when God enters the garden at the end of the chapter, he says, behold, they have become like us, knowing good and evil. So the serpent is the really good liar. He uses the truth to deceive. Mm-hmm. But I would suggest to you that when the serpent says you will not die, something more is going on, and that is an implied threat. He's saying, in effect, if you eat this tree, you won't die. In other words, read my lips. If you don't eat this tree, I, a murderous Satan, am going to see to it that you pay a price for obedience. In other words, this is what scholars call a trial by ordeal. Adam should be stepping in at this point and saying, you know, Satan, right, you ought to go to the pit that God has prepared for you.
Oh, that's my thinking. My question is, here is Eve being interrogated. What should Adam have done in that situation?
Yeah, I think, you know, the best way to interpret this particular response is to see it in light of what Christ later does. We'll get to that in a minute. But I think he should have said, you know, stepped forward and said, hey, you know, serpent, you have no business in here. In the name of God, be gone. And, you know, what would have happened at this point? If the serpent is really Satan, as the scriptures tell us, what would he have done? Would he have just stuck his tail between his legs and gone off whimpering to the hellfires? I doubt it. It suggests that there may well have been a kind of struggle. Mm-hmm. Now, man is immortal, you know, and if he doesn't sin, he is going to enter glory. But I would suggest to you that Adam is being challenged by a test of faith here. He would size up the situation and say, wait a second now, I'm supposed to be immortal, but here's a life-threatening force in the form of this serpent. I'm supposed to have dominion over the beasts, and yet here is a beast with murderous capacities. And looking at things by my natural reason, and judging from my own natural position over nature, I should be able to eat this tree because it's a tree, and I'm allowed to eat trees. Moreover, as it says, the tree is good for food. It's a delight to the eyes, and the tree was desirable to make one wise. So why can't I eat it? And if I don't eat it, the serpent seems to be implying something, that if we don't eat this, if you do eat it, you won't die. Well, that could be, you know, mean that if we don't eat it, he's going to spring into action. So Adam is really being called upon to make a decision. He's being called upon to give consent to his own self-offering. He is to enter into a kind of spiritual warfare with the serpent, with the devil, to destroy the works of the devil from the very foundation of the world. And he looks and he sizes up the situation, but instead of walking by faith, instead of just simply saying, I don't know why we can't eat the tree, I don't know why my immortality seems to be threatened, but nevertheless, I have to obey my Father who is in heaven. I have to be willing to lay my life down for my bride. After all, as Jesus says, greater love hath no man than to lay down his life for his beloved. So Adam's love is being tested here, his love for Eve, his trust in God, the Father, and he fails that. See, I think this approach builds upon the early church fathers. This approach also builds upon what I've read in the Catechism, and it avoids these two extremes. I think most people who interpret this tend toward one extreme or the other. They either trivialize the sin by making this couple just a bunch of bumbling fools who's like, you know, look at the tree. Wow, great fruit. You're right, serpent. Thanks. You know, and they take it and eat it. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you can exaggerate the sin by making Adam's act an expression of rebellious defiance that just doesn't befit the initial sin. I mean, that kind of sin, you know, where Adam would look and say, yes, I am the master of my fate, I'm the captain of my soul, and he takes the fruit and he eats it and says, you know, God, I will be I will be my own God. You know, that sort of defiant gesture takes place only after years of habitual sin. Mm-hmm. So we either trivialize the sin or we exaggerate it. But in fact, you know, Hebrews 2, verses 14 to 16, quoted by the Catechism, describes how Christ died, and through his death, he defeated the devil who has the power of death. Mm-hmm. And because of this power of death that the devil possessed, it says in Hebrews 2, that we were subjected to lifelong bondage to the one who has the power of death. Why? Through fear of death. Through fear of death.
That brings up one last question I'd like you to address real quickly, and that is, you talk about Adam being afraid of suffering. How could Adam be afraid of suffering before he sinned?
That's a good question. That's a good question. I would say quickly and simply that God issues the commandment saying, if you eat this forbidden fruit, you will die. Now, if Adam does not dread death, then that prohibition and threat would mean nothing to him.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, if you look at our Lord Jesus, he is in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he is sinless. And yet, when faced with the prospect of suffering, he is sweating blood. He is on his face. He is praying to his Father that this cup of suffering be removed. And so it isn't true to say that apart from sin, we would have no dread of suffering. Adam would have had a healthy dread of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we can't go into all of this, but I would say that the key to interpreting what the first Adam did and what he should have done is by looking at Christ,
mm-hmm.
because he is the second Adam. That's how he's described throughout the New Testament. And here is the second Adam. He also is tested. He also goes to the garden, and there he is tempted. And then he goes to the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And there at the tree, he lays his life down for the bride,
for
his church. And he has assumed the curse of Adam upon himself, the curse of sweat, the curse of thorns. He sweat blood. He bore the crown of thorns. And there at the cross, the tree of life, as the early church fathers called it, he laid his life down. And from Adam's side, remember, from the deep sleep of Adam came forth Eve. Well, the second Adam goes to the tree, and in the deep sleep of death came forth from his side blood and water, the water of baptism, the blood of the Eucharist, as the early church fathers interpreted, the very stuff, the sacramental material from which the new Eve, the church, the bride of Christ, is formed.
It reminds me of the scripture, perfect love casts out fear.
Exactly.
Isn't that beautiful? You know, I was thinking as you were talking, we were talking a little bit earlier, a quote from Mother Teresa. And it's right along these lines. It just beautifully puts kind of a closure to this. She says that we cannot decide to become saints without a great effort of renunciation, of resisting temptations, of combat, of persecution, and of all sorts of sacrifices. It is not possible to love God except at one's own expense.
Oh, that's good. It is not possible to love God except at one's own expense.
Right.
See, God calls us to love like the Trinity loves. The Father pours his life out to generate the Son. The Son images the Father by pouring that life, that gift, out, and he gives it back to the Father, which is the Spirit. God calls us to enter into that life,
mm-hmm.
but we can't unless we give consent to the gift of self.
That's beautiful.
To the sacrifice of self.
That's beautiful. What a challenge.
It really is, indeed.
Let's move ahead just a little bit in salvation history to Abraham. We talked about the three promises in Genesis chapter 12. And what I'd like to ask you is, how does the call of Abraham relate to the three covenants that were mentioned in Genesis 15, 17, and 22?
Okay, good. Abram's called in Genesis 12 by God as Father. And it comes right on the heels of the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11. At the Tower of Babel, the human family was scattered and divided. From the Father's perspective in heaven, you might think, oh, now all the hopes of family unity are lost. But no, God calls Abraham specifically for a long-term plan to reunite the human family of God. But he can't do it right away. The effects of sin take a long time to overcome. And so the call of Abraham is really divided up into three parts. You can see it in Genesis 12, verses 2 and 3. He says, first of all, go to this land so that I can make of you a great nation. Because without land, there can be no nationhood. So the first promise is that God will make of Abram a great nation. I will bless you. And then the second promise comes closely on the heels. And I will make your name great. That's a Hebrew expression for a dynastic kingdom. That is, not only will I draw forth a nation from you, but I will make your name great. I will give you a dynastic kingdom so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who curses you I will curse. And here comes the climax. By you, all the families of the earth will be blessed.
Mm-hmm.
All the families of the earth will be blessed. Now, in Genesis, the blessing is what the Father passes on down to the Son. So through Abraham, God is going to pass down the fatherly blessing to the entire human family so that the human race will be the family of God by becoming the spiritual family of Abraham. Now, those three blessings, those three promised blessings, represent three stages. One sort of long remote, the other one would be more proximate, and the third would be ultimate. This first one, the remote blessing, nationhood, is upgraded to a covenant in Genesis 15. In Genesis 15, we see God taking the first promised blessing, nationhood, and land, and swearing a covenant to Abram. In Genesis 15, we have the covenant that God makes with Abram regarding a vast amount of land that stretches all the way from Egypt to the Euphrates. That covenant was fulfilled not only through the Israelites, but through the Ishmaelites, through the Arabs, because Ishmael is a son of Abraham at this point in the Genesis narrative. So the covenant with Abram makes all the natural seed of Abram heirs to this initial promise. So they get this vast chunk of land from Egypt all the way to Babylon. Now the second promise is upgraded to a covenant in Genesis 17. But that covenant is made between God and Abraham. He changes his name from exalted father, Abram, to father of a multitude, Abraham. And at this point, and only at this point, does God specifically state that Canaan is going to be the land for the seed of Abraham.
So the name change there.
Exactly. And the land is narrowed, too. It isn't just from Egypt to the Euphrates. It's now specified as Canaan. Moreover, it isn't just nationhood now. In Genesis 17, he says, kings of people shall come forth from Abraham and Sarah. There in verse 16. So this covenant actually points beyond. It points to what is ultimately accomplished in the Davidic covenant. But still, this is something that is penultimate. It's second to last, because God's ultimate plan for his family is not simply to make of the natural seed of Abram a great landed people, or even to make of the people of Abraham a strong secular kingdom. Instead, he wants to make them the means of blessing all the world. So in Genesis 22, we see the last and the greatest of the promised blessings, that through you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. In Genesis 22, God swears an oath to Abraham. After Abraham had offered up Isaac, his only beloved son, as a holocaust there at Moriah, God stops the sacrifice right before it takes place and says, Abraham, Abraham, here I am. And he says, because you have not withheld your only beloved son from me, what will your reward be? I swear an oath, I swear by myself that through your seed, all the families of the earth will be blessed. This is just tremendous. This is momentous, because for the first time in history, God explicitly puts himself under oath. He puts himself under a conditional self-curse.
That's hard to believe.
It really is. And it's not only something that God verbalizes. That is, I swear this covenant oath. I will bless all the nations and make them your family and my family through your seed. God also pre-enacts. He almost represents. He displays to the world, centuries before the coming of Christ, what will have to take place in order for this covenant blessing to be realized. Namely, God will say, in effect, Abraham, I'll pick up where you left off. I am a faithful father like you, Abraham, and I will take my only beloved son, the same phrase is used in John's gospel, Jesus, who is the son of Abraham, and I will offer him as a holocaust as well, there on Calvary, which was part of the mountain range of Moriah. And thereby, God will provide the lamb that will take away the sins of the world and remove the impediment that prevents the blessings of God the Father from reaching the whole human family.
So this covenant with Abraham, in a sense, is sort of like a safety net all throughout salvation history.
Yes. Yeah, it's sort of like mankind is walking across a tightrope. But in a sense, God's merciful provision is even greater than a safety net.
Mm-hmm.
God foresees our fall, and he makes provisions in his wisdom and mercy. And the safety net he puts under the high wire is the covenant. But instead of just being a safety net, when we fall into his covenant mercies, we discover that the safety net is more like a trampoline.
Yeah.
It's something that bounces us back to the rope from whence we fell. In fact, in a certain sense, you could say that when Jesus Christ comes and offers himself as a sacrifice, we are raised even higher
than from whence we fell.
Yeah.
You know, this is a deep subject, and it's something we need to learn more about.
Yeah.
Can you tell our viewers, is there a tape series that you have that you might suggest that goes into this deeper?
Yeah, I've done a tape series on Genesis 1 to 22 that's available through St. Joseph Communication. You can just call them up. Their number is 1-800-526-2151.
Okay.
800-526-2151, okay. And you can order this, and there we unpack it in much greater detail.
Well, as you can see, the Bible is a beautiful story, a beautiful plan. We're going to look into it more. And in this segment of the program, what we're attempting to do is to help you read through the Bible in chronological order. As mentioned earlier, the Bible can be a very difficult book to read. A total of 73 books, yet one book, and many stories, but yet one story. And the challenge for us is to break down those 73 books into a system where we can read the Bible in chronological order. And that's what we're attempting to do. So we broke down the Bible into 14 historical books. And by historical books, we mean to keep the narrative moving. And to help us memorize those 14 historical books and the 12 periods of Bible history, we're on our third bead on this program. It's the Tan bead. And our card tells us that the Tan bead stands for Israel in Egypt. And that's our third period. And we just left the patriarchal period, started with the history of the early world, moved on to the patriarchal period. Now we're in Israel and Egypt. The period of Israel and Egypt is an intriguing period. One-sixth of the Old Testament is dedicated to this period. This period comes on the heels of Joseph finding himself down in Egypt. You may remember from the last program during the patriarchal period that God made three promises to Abram. And the first of those promises was that Abraham was going to receive land, that his descendants would receive land. But he said in Genesis 15 and verse 13 that first, before they received that land, that his descendants would spend 400 years in slavery in a foreign land. And we know that land to be Egypt. So we move into our next historical book. We're moving out of Genesis, and now we're moving into Exodus, our second historical book. You can look on the chart behind me here. The 14 historical books, we just moved out of Genesis, and now we're moving into Exodus, the second of our 14 historical books. The book of Genesis picks up with the children of Israel in slavery in Egypt, and they have been slaves for 400 years. The star at this point, the individual that God points out as the leader, is Moses, Moshe. Young Moses, he is born, and the Egyptians try to kill Moses, but God ends up saving Moses. And God uses Moses to deliver the children of Israel out of bondage. Now, this story of the deliverance of the children of Israel will become very important for understanding the rest of the Bible. There's a lot of things that take place during the book of Exodus. If you've tried to read through the book of Exodus before and got confused, a little bit later on in the program, Dr. Scott Hahn is going to be with us, and he's going to clarify some of those rumble strips, some of those difficult areas during the book of Exodus. Up until the book of Exodus, the blessing was passed on to the firstborn through the patriarchs. And during the book of Exodus, we see that God is raising the entire nation. They're sort of growing up. The 400 years have been boot camp for the children of Israel. But they're growing up. And Exodus 4, in verse 22, God calls Israel his firstborn. Israel is God's firstborn. And they have a responsibility to be that vehicle to bring the blessing to all of the nations. But they need to be formed and they need to be developed. And this is what takes place during the book of Exodus. Moses and Pharaoh collide. Moses and Pharaoh collide. You see, God speaks to Moses in a burning bush and tells him, Moses, I'm going to use you to deliver my people out of bondage, but you're going to have to go to Pharaoh. Moses doesn't want to do this. Reluctantly, he does, and he's very successful. We have at this point during the book of Exodus the 10 plagues. Now, it's on the 10th plague, the death of the firstborn, that the Exodus takes place. The Exodus takes place in the Passover, Pesach in Hebrew. The Passover is the principal event in the Old Testament. It's the event that speaks of deliverance. Jesus is our Passover lamb, and he brings deliverance to our lives. The children of Israel make a covenant. Moses and the 70 elders, they make a covenant with God at Mount Sinai in Exodus chapter 19. And God gives them his law. He gives them Torah. Now, the minute we talk about Torah, what do we think of? A lot of times we think of right and wrong, yes, no, stop signs and so forth. But you know, to the ancient Jews, Torah was a good thing. And David said, oh, how I love thy Torah, or how I love thy law. The word Torah comes from a Hebrew word, yara, which is a archer's term. It means to hit the mark. You see, God wants his people to hit the mark. And so he gives them direction. He gives them law to hit the mark. Something takes place on the heels of this covenant at Mount Sinai. And that is the golden calf incident in Exodus chapter 32. Now, Dr. Hahn is going to be with us in a few moments to discuss this. And I would encourage you to stay tuned because this is very, very important. Because in Exodus chapter 32, something takes place with the worship of the golden calf that is going to completely change God's plan with man. Completely change it. We come up with a temple, a tabernacle. We have additional laws. We have the Levitical priesthood. And if you're like me and you've read through the book of Exodus, you come to all of the sacrifices and you come to the tabernacle and Moses and you get confused. I know I have for years. And we hope to sort that out in a few minutes. After the golden calf incident, we have a Levitical priesthood. Dr. Hahn is going to explain that, make sense of the book of Leviticus. So we're going to return in just a few minutes, and we're going to look at the book of Exodus, and we're going to look at the golden calf incident and a couple of other incidents during the book of Exodus. But if you're reading along with us, I encourage you, read Genesis 1 through 11 for the history of the early world. And so the chart to my right shows these periods of history. Read Genesis 1 through 11 for the history of the early world. And then after you're done reading 1 through 11, move on to your next period, the patriarchal period, Genesis 12 through 50. After Genesis 12 through 50, which talks about the four patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, you will enter the period called Israel in Egypt. And you move from your first historical book, which is Genesis, to your second historical book, which is Exodus. That's your second historical book. And if you would like to obtain this, as I said earlier, the beads and the card and a complete package into telling you how to read through the Bible with some charts, just give us a call at EWTN or write, and they will let you know how you can obtain that package. We'll be back right after this with Dr. Scott Hahn. We're going to be looking at some more theological concepts on our Father's plan.
Teach us, good Lord, to serve you as you deserve, to give and not to count the cost, to fight and not to heed the wounds, to toil and not to seek for rest, to labor and not ask for any reward, save that of knowing that we do your will.
I want to welcome you back to Our Father's Plan. Well, we have entered a new book, a new period of history. We moved out of the patriarchal period into Israel and Egypt. We moved from the book of Genesis into the book of Exodus. Give us a little bridge. How do we get from the patriarchal age into Israel and Egypt, move from the two books?
Yeah, it's important that we build a bridge, because so often when people are done with Genesis, they just put it aside and begin reading Exodus. But the two really interpret each other. For instance, we see in Exodus the beginning of the fulfillment of God's covenant with Abraham regarding Abraham's seed blessing the nations. For instance, we have in Exodus 4:22, the verse you just discussed a few minutes ago, this important statement that God makes to Moses, "Go tell Pharaoh, Israel is my firstborn son." Well, that doesn't imply a monopoly of God's favor on the part of Israel. What that really points to is the fact that Israel as a nation is sort of like God's firstborn son, but that means all the nations, including Egypt, are at least potential members of God's family, younger brothers of Israel, younger sons of God the Father.
That's an important point to make, because a lot of people think that the Bible is just about Israel, and it's not just about Israel, is it? It's about everybody.
Exactly. And another part of the bridge between Genesis and Exodus is the idea of the firstborn son, because in the patriarchal period, before the Levites became priests, the firstborn sons were supposed to assume royal priestly authority. Mm-hmm. So in effect, throughout Genesis, you have firstborn sons slated to receive royal priestly blessing. But what Genesis indicates, it's so important for grasping Exodus' message, is that beginning with Adam, and then moving through Cain, moving through Ishmael, Esau, Reuben, and all of the other firstborn sons, except for Noah's firstborn son, Shem, every other firstborn son in Genesis fails to obtain the blessing and has to be bypassed by the father, so that the blessing goes from the father not to the firstborn, but to the second or the thirdborn or the fourth and so on. So by the time you get to Exodus 4:22, God's announcement, Israel is my firstborn son, that's a mixed signal. On the one hand, it's good news. You know, Israel is to be a kingdom of priests, as Exodus 19:6 says. But on the other hand, looking at Genesis, you recognize that every other firstborn son except for Shem was a failure. Mm-hmm. So this calling from God the Father to Israel, his firstborn son, is a conditional calling. You'll have to be faithful. If you hear my voice, if you keep my covenant, then and only then will you be a kingdom of priests. So, you know, in effect, Israel is to the nations in Exodus what Adam was to all individual human persons in Genesis. Adam is the firstborn son who falls in Genesis, bringing sin to all persons. Israel is God's firstborn son nation in Exodus, and when Israel falls with the golden calf, it brings calamitous confusion to God's family plan. It really suspends certain aspects of that plan, as we'll see in a minute.
You know, Dr. Hahn, I have read the Bible for 20 years now, and I know that in trying to read through the Bible, as many of our viewers are trying to do with us, read from Genesis through Exodus and on, it seems that from Genesis to Exodus, it's a very simple story.
Right.
And then suddenly you come to Exodus, and you come to the Passover, the Exodus and the Passover and the Mount Sinai covenant, and all of a sudden things become so complicated, things become so confused. We have a tabernacle, we have the Levitical priesthood, we have all these sacrifices that we don't really identify with. What has happened in the book of Exodus that seems to have ruptured this beautiful streamlined plan into a confusing plan to us?
Yeah, that's a very good question. If you keep that bridge in mind, you're able to travel into Exodus and make more progress, because Israel's God's firstborn son, and God commands Pharaoh to let him go to serve me, or else I'll slay your firstborn sons. That sets the stage for the Passover, where the firstborn sons of Egypt are slain so that God's firstborn son can be redeemed and given this royal priestly mission to all of the younger brother nations. But why slay the lamb? That's the interesting thing. Why does God call Israel out of Egypt over to Mount Sinai to offer up animal sacrifices in this covenant-making ratification ceremony in Exodus 24? The key to that, the secret, is found in Exodus 8:26, where Moses announces to Pharaoh God's initial plan, Plan A. Plan A was simply, let Israel go for 3 days out to Sinai to sacrifice, and then they'll return and begin working again. And then God, of course, told Moses, it's not going to happen. Pharaoh's going to harden his heart, and so I'm going to have to liberate you completely. But Moses says, you know, Pharaoh says, okay, go, fine, sacrifice to your God, but do it in this land. Don't go out in the wilderness, because how do I know you're going to come back?
Mm-hmm.
But Moses said, it would not be right to do so, for we shall sacrifice to the Lord our God offerings abominable to the Egyptians. If we sacrifice offerings abominable to the Egyptians before their eyes, will they not stone us?
Hmm.
Now, what does that statement imply? Well, the ancient rabbis, the early church fathers, understood it very clearly. So did St. Thomas. That what God required of Israel was for Israel to slaughter animals that the Egyptians venerated.
Hmm.
The idols that were worshipped in Egypt were worshipped under the form of cattle, sheep, and goats. Those were the three animals deemed sacred by the Egyptians. They sacrificed many other animals, but never those three. And in fact, they would sacrifice their other animals to their gods under the form of cattle, sheep, and goats. And so God, in effect, is saying, in order for you to make a clean break from the idolatry of Egypt, I want you, Israel, to slaughter symbolically the gods, the idols of Egypt, by sacrificing cattle, sheep, and goats to me at Sinai. When you repudiate the gods of Egypt, you can have me as your God once again.
Hmm.
This echoes in Joshua 24, the opening verses, also in Ezekiel 20, verses 5 to 26, where you hear elsewhere in the Bible that Israel had been in Egypt for so long that they'd actually absorbed the idolatrous ways of the Egyptians, and they had to make a clean break and renounce this idolatry.
So this initial sacrifice then that's spoken of here in chapter 8 is really to get Egypt out of Israel?
Yeah. The exodus, the liberation, is not only political, it's spiritual. That is, I want you to be free from the idolatrous bondage of Egypt, not just the political slavery of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
They were enslaved to Egypt not only externally, but internally. In order for Yahweh to be the God of Israel, they had to renounce and actually symbolically slaughter, sacrifice the gods of Egypt, which they did in the Passover in the form of the lamb, and then they do at Mount Sinai in Exodus 24 in the form of cattle, sheep, and goats. So in effect, this whole ceremony is restoration through renunciation. Israel is making this break from the ways of Egypt, and in that way they're being reunited to God, to Yahweh as Father, so they can begin fulfilling their royal priestly mission as God's firstborn son nation to all the other nations.
Okay, so the children of Israel are at Mount Sinai.
Yeah.
And God makes a covenant with Israel at Mount Sinai. What does this mean?
Well, in Exodus 19, he offers them a covenant. He says, in effect, if you keep my covenant, you'll be a kingdom of priests, which follows from their firstborn status as a nation. In Exodus 20, the Ten Commandments are given. That summarizes the law, the wisdom of the Father for his firstborn son. If you live this law and break from the idols of Egypt, and if you live out my own fatherly wisdom, all the nations will see your obedience, see your prosperity, see our covenant intimacy, and desire it. And in Exodus 21, 22, and 23, additional laws are given to kind of help Israel gradually make that break. The final covenant is ratified, however, in Exodus 24. That's where the cattle, sheep, and goats are all slaughtered. The blood is thrown upon the altar, representing God's side of the covenant oath. And then the blood is also thrown upon the heads of the people. That symbolizes the fact that Israel likewise is bound by covenant oath to the Lord. They're both now bound by covenant oath to each other.
Now, when reading through the book of Exodus, would you agree that chapter 32, the golden calf incident, is the critical chapter in understanding really the whole, the sacramental system, the Levitical system, the tabernacle?
Precisely. Now we can see, I think, more clearly why that's the case. In Exodus 32, Moses is atop Mount Sinai for 40 days of fasting. During that time, Israel gets Aaron to build a golden calf. In other words, they've returned to the gods of Egypt. The bull is a sign of Apis, one of the great gods of the Egyptian idolatrous religions. And so, though they have come out of Egypt, Egypt has not come out of them. And up until the golden calf, All of the fathers of the 12 tribes of Israel had a priestly role. All of the firstborn sons of Israel also had a kind of royal priestly calling. Every Israelite family could have been like a little church, a little tabernacle. Only after the golden calf, when the Levites slaughtered the 3,000 idolaters, does Moses ordain the Levites to be priests instead of all the fathers and the firstborn sons from all 12 tribes. Before the golden calf then, every family is sacred, every father is like a high priest, every firstborn son is like a deacon or a priest under the father, so that every family meal would have been sacred, sacrificial. God would have been dwelling in every Israelite family. But after Israel goes back to the gods of Egypt, they forfeit that royal priestly privilege, and it's given exclusively to the Levites, because only the Levites obeyed the Lord at Sinai, taking their swords at Moses' command and slaughtering 3,000 of the worshipers of the golden calf. He said, today you've ordained yourselves to be priests in Israel.
You see, that makes understanding the book of Exodus so much more clear.
Yeah, it really does.
It really does. It's amazing. Go ahead.
Okay, well, before the golden calf, then, we have the situation where the law is relatively simple. We have the Decalogue, and sacrifices take place in Exodus 24. But in the Ten Commandments, there are no requirements for daily offerings. Up until the golden calf, you could offer animal sacrifices if you wanted to after the ratification ceremony, but you didn't have to. It was optional. It was voluntary, discretionary. But after the golden calf, God says, you will offer every morning and evening these animals that you have been venerating secretly in this idolatry.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in effect, God is saying, you said at the oath that you would break, but then at the golden calf, you returned to the gods of Egypt. Now that you've returned, I command you every day to break with those gods. It's sort of like...
those are the sacrifices.
Exactly. The animal sacrifices that every day require Israel to renounce idolatry. It's sort of like if a wife was married to an alcoholic and she said, look, Tom, you know, 10 times now you have repudiated alcohol, and I believe you every time, but no more. What I'm going to require of you every morning and every evening, if we're to stay together here, and she hands him a bottle of Jack Daniels and says, you must smash that bottle in the sink this morning and again this evening if I am going to stay with you, because I see that this bottle is your God, and you must break with the God, in effect. And so God is saying to Israel, in effect, every day you must slaughter the gods that you had been secretly worshiping if you're going to have me as your true Father and Lord.
So before the golden calf incident, there seems to be a level of intimacy between God and his people. At least God desires there to be a level of intimacy, that when sin comes, the golden calf incident takes place, the intimacy diminishes between
That's right.
God and his people. And that's what sin does.
Yeah. Before the golden calf, there was no reason why God's spirit would not dwell in all of the tents of the 12 tribes of Israel. But in the golden calf incident, all of that is lost. If all 12 tribes were priestly before, only the tribe of Levi is priestly afterwards. If sacrifices could have been offered in all of the tents of the 12 tribes before, after the golden calf, only in the tabernacle that is erected right after the golden calf, mm-hmm. and Aaron is installed as the high priest. So you have a whole load of additional ceremonial laws that revolve around animal sacrifice, Aaron's high priesthood, the tabernacle. In other words, at this point, God is withdrawing from Israel. Now, you might say, that doesn't seem fair. But the only reason God is doing it is because Israel had already withdrawn from the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
God is just simply honoring their request. He's saying, I called you to covenant intimacy. You said yes, but your actions said no.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just going to basically respond to your actions, because your actions speak louder than your words. But I'm not going to let you go. I'm not going to let you return to those gods. I'm going to make you slaughter those gods, not just once at Sinai, but once, twice a day, every day, for centuries, for over 1,000 years, until finally I root out of your heart the heart of stone. I uproot the heart of stone, as mm-hmm. he says in Ezekiel 36, and I'll give you a new heart. So not until a future covenant is made will Israel's real spiritual problem be resolved.
Talk just for a moment about the tabernacle. The tabernacle can seem very, very complicated. There are many, many chapters in the Bible that are dedicated to the description, the building of it, all the different instruments in the tabernacle. What is the role of the tabernacle now in Israel's history?
Yeah, at this point in time, the tabernacle is God's dwelling place. In Exodus 33, the tabernacle had to be pitched outside the camp of Israel because the camp was defiled.
Mm-hmm.
So God wants to dwell in the midst of his people. So he has to add all these laws to make it possible. What are the laws? He says, okay, we're going to put my tabernacle back in the middle of the 12 tribes, but it's going to have to be cordoned off, surrounded by the four clans of the tribe of Levi.
The price of sin.
Exactly. The cushioning of the Levites, then, is the result of the golden calf. Whenever we sin, we distance ourselves from God, but God is never going to abandon us. But he will allow our sins to have their effects. He will manifest those effects to us. He will allow us, in fact, he will force us to accept the consequence of our sin, which is this greater distance between ourselves and God. And so the tabernacle represents God's own loving presence in the midst of his family. But the Levitical tribe that surrounds the tabernacle is a constant reminder to Israel of their fall. The rabbis used to say that what the forbidden fruit was to Adam, the golden calf was to Israel. As Adam forfeited his royal priestly authority to transmit blessings to every person, to all of his progeny, by eating the forbidden fruit, so likewise, Israel forfeited the royal priestly privilege as a firstborn son nation to freely transmit God's blessing, salvation to all the nations. Instead, the Levites became the priestly conduit to transmit God's blessings back to the 12 tribes.
Who would hopefully bless all of be a blessing to the nation.
That's right. This is the key to understanding the Levitical laws that follow the golden calf. You see, in the golden calf, we have Exodus 32 to 34. And then at the end of Exodus 35 to 40, we have the instructions concerning erecting the tabernacle and consecrating Aaron as the high priest.
Mm-hmm.
Then Leviticus begins. Boy, when people read the what are you about to say? I can read your thoughts.
Well, you know, when you read through the Bible, you have these Bible reading programs where you start in January and you go through it. When do people stop? They stop in March because they're in Leviticus.
And that's right.
They think, well, this does not edify me in my daily devotion.
Yeah, that's right. Along with the March rain and the March mud comes the book of Leviticus.
Yeah.
And you get bogged down in all of the details describing the sacrifices.
Well, explain the book of Leviticus. Where does this fit?
Well, once you see the significance of the golden calf as the hinge on which the covenant now turns, you can recognize that Leviticus is neatly divided into two parts. Leviticus 1 to 16 is the priestly code. Leviticus 17...
Who's that for? Who's the priestly code for?
Okay, the first half of Leviticus is a guidebook to train the Levites in their new task of getting the 12 tribes back on track with God.
Okay.
The second half of Leviticus, 17 to 27, is known as the Holiness Code. The second half of Leviticus, the Holiness Code, consists of the instructions that the Levites must pass down to the 12 tribes to rehabilitate them in order to get them back on track. So you have two books in Leviticus, in effect. You have the priestly code to train the priests in their new Levitical duties, and then you have the Holiness Code, so the Levites know what they're to teach the 12 tribes as the new teacher of Israel, as sort of like, they're almost like babysitters, if you will. They have to be super strict in overseeing and administering the 12 tribes to keep them from returning to the idols, the gods of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
When you approach the book of Leviticus that way, you'll recognize that all the animals that God requires Israel to sacrifice, he has no need for. He takes no delight in these animal sacrifices. But he does recognize that Israel needs to sacrifice those animals in order to constantly make that clean break from idolatry. And then all of a sudden, the sacrifices of Leviticus become an educational tool for the father to teach his wayward son, his rebellious son.
And that's what Paul says, doesn't he?
Exactly. Why then the law? It was added because of transgression.
Mm-hmm.
Or in Hebrews 7, verse 12, where there is a change in the priesthood, there is a change in the law. The change in the priesthood from the firstborn sons to the Levites, a change in the law, from the simple Ten Commandments and the covenant code to all of the additional burdensome, penitential regulations and sacrifices and ceremonies by which God in effect, slowly rehabilitates.
Dr. Hahn, your teaching has made reading the Bible a lot of fun because it puts everything in perspective. As we start reading through the scriptures, and our viewers are reading with us, they start in the book of Genesis, and then they come to the book of Exodus. And right there, at chapter 32, you can start reading Leviticus, and you read it in context, knowing what it's about, who it's addressed to, and what the purposes of the book are.
And by the way, I'm flattered that you say it's my approach, but it's really a very new, old approach. It's the approach, as you know.
But you make it simple.
Yeah, you know, it's reflected in the Targums, the ancient Jewish Bible that was used probably some form of it in Jesus' day.
The Targums are the Aramaic translation.
Right, exactly. We also find it in the rabbinic writings. We find it in the early church fathers. St. Thomas Aquinas takes it for granted in the Summa Theologica, the Prima Secundae, section 102. He just describes all these ceremonial sacrifices as a penitential addition because of the golden calf.
Mm-hmm.
Even Martin Luther, who inherited so much through his training as an Augustinian monk, took all of this for granted in interpreting the Bible. It's really been in the last two centuries or so that a lot of this is lost through the misuse of certain historical critical tools and methods.
That's wonderful. I enjoy talking to you about this. You know, there's nothing as exciting as reading the Bible, and you know that I really mean that. It's an adventure. When you pick up on the book of Genesis and you read all the way through about our Father's plan, it really is an adventure. Our next book that we're going to be looking at is the book of Numbers. We're going to travel from Genesis to Exodus, and you can read Leviticus in the context of Exodus. We're going to move on to the book of Numbers. And so read up on Numbers before our next program. This is Our Father's Plan. Jeff Cavins and Dr. Scott Hahn with you. We're looking forward to seeing you next time.
This has been Our Father's Plan with Jeff Cavins and Scott Hahn.